Well, Christmas is in the air again, and you know it's my favorite time of the year, and our holiday spirit is already on overdrive. Tomorrow, our campus will come alive with lights and decorations outside all over the place. And we've also kicked off our annual Giving Tree and our holiday food drive programs this year. And we're also taking it to a whole new level. We've got a tree lighting ceremony that's going to happen in downtown Tiburon on December 3rd, this Saturday at 4:30 p.m., and our band will be there, and it's going to be an amazing experience. I hope you can come. But check out the Christmas page of our website for all the fun. The reason I love Christmas so much is that it's always been, for me, about hope. One of my favorite childhood memories is going to bed on Christmas Eve by candlelight. Our parents would shut off all the lights in the house, except, of course, the Christmas tree. And then we would take a single candle. This was a beloved Scandinavian tradition. We'd take a single candle with us to our bedrooms. I remember being 4 years old, holding a little candle, going up the stairs. And when we got to our rooms, you know, we'd place the candle in the windowsill like a watchman looking out into the dark, cold night. And I remember my mom would sit next to me on the bed, and she would kiss me goodnight, as she did every night. But then Christmas Eve was different because of the candlelight. And I would also listen intently and try my best to stay awake long enough to hear the hooves of Santa's reindeer on the roof. It never happened. Santa, you know, he's tricky that way. But it felt warm and safe and hopeful. But, you know, today our world is kind of worried. It's worried. I don't mean to sound like a downer, but it seems to me that for a lot of people, worry has replaced hope. And I don't think it's just about, you know, the senseless gun violence or the economy or the war in Ukraine or inflation. I think it goes deeper than that. Over the last 100 years, several hundred years actually, in our postmodern world, a lot of people have learned to carry on day after day without a lot of hope in their lives. For many people, they've lost faith in God and the daily experience of His love. Or they've lost trust in the essential goodness of people. Or they've lost confidence in the belief that we can overcome and even celebrate our differences in, you know, race and politics, culture and religion. And for many people, religion is now considered a luxury, and faith is more difficult than unbelief. More and more, it seems, there is simply no real source of hope in our modern-day culture. Of course, there are still many optimists out there, and despite what I've just said, I'm one of them. I'm an optimist. But, you know, I see it often enough. Hope is something that a lot of people have lost. And yet, hope is essential to human existence. You can't really live without hope. It's a virtue that God has placed in our hearts, in the heart of every human person, to, you know, keep us from becoming discouraged and to sustain us through dark times. Hope is what makes us generous people. Hope is what makes us happy people. To put it bluntly, without hope, there's really not much to live for. One of my favorite Christmas movies, and to be honest, it's a recent favorite, is a movie called It's a Wonderful Life. You've probably seen it. It's an old movie, and it stars Jimmy Stewart as a character named George Bailey. And at the end of that movie, George Bailey is standing on a bridge outside his hometown, Bedford Falls, New York, on Christmas Eve in 1945. He was the president of the town's struggling building and loan association, and for decades he had helped people realize their dream of home ownership. It was not the career that he had imagined for himself, but over the years he came to accept it. And over the years he had struggled and struggled. There were many hardships, including a kind of a depression era run on the bank. Many other things went wrong, with the bank, but he still managed to stay in business through all of it. But now, on Christmas Eve, a large deposit had been lost, and the bank examiner had arrived for an audit at the same time. And George Bailey knew that the shortfall in the funds meant scandal, bankruptcy, and maybe even prison for him. And so he lost all hope, and he saw no reason to continue living. But if you've seen the movie, you know that that's not where it ends. There's a heavenly intervention, an angel, and George ultimately rediscovers a reason for living and comes to realize that no matter what the circumstances are, with enough hope, it still can be a wonderful life. So to help us stay focused on the hopeful side of things and to grow in hope this holiday season, we're kicking off a brand new message series this weekend that will take us all the way through the season of Advent and to Christmas Eve. We're calling the series, like the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. Take a look. Throughout this series, we're going to discover that hope actually is everywhere when you look for it. But we're going to be looking at four important ways that we can find hope again in God's plan for our lives and in the prophets and the messengers that he sends to us. We can find hope in his constant and abiding presence and in his promise to return one day. And that's where we're going to start tonight. God's promise to return. The promise that Jesus will come back one day. And you know, for some people, when you talk about the second coming, they get very nervous or they get very dubious or cynical. It's like, okay, it's been 2,000 years. When is this going to happen? Maybe never. Maybe not in my lifetime. Probably not in my lifetime. And some people will also feel afraid because it seems to come with some judgment. The second coming of Christ can feel a little unsettling to people. And there's a good reason for that. If you look at the gospel passage this week, Jesus describes what it will be like when he returns. He compares it to the Old Testament story of Noah and the ark. You probably know that story, right? God destroyed the earth with a great flood, but he warned Noah ahead of time, and he built an ark for his family and for many of the creatures on earth. And then Jesus says, in those days before the flood, you know, everybody was eating and drinking and just having a good time. They were just living life. They were marrying. Everything seemed normal. Right up until the day when the flood came and wiped them all away. And he says, so will it also be when the Son of Man comes. A little disconcerting. The same thing may happen for some people when Jesus comes again, he says. It's a surprise. And that can seem like a frightening proposition. But the promise of the Lord to return one day is actually supposed to be hopeful for us. It's supposed to give us hope. Think about it this way. It's a huge spoiler alert for how the story of creation, God's story, our story, comes to an end. No matter how scary and nerve-wracking this world is or becomes, we know that ultimately God's love will win in the end. The very basis of Christian hope is founded in that promise. The promise of Jesus to come back and make everything right. But that promise also comes with a responsibility, right? It comes with a responsibility for us to live like people with hope. People who have hope that good will eventually conquer evil. People who live with that kind of hope who also make decisions that are consistent with that hope. And you know, if you look at the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah, what we heard in the first reading, there's a great example of that, a lesson for the Jewish people that also applies to us today. The story is a vision of hope for the ancient Jewish people. It's told by a man named Isaiah, who lived about 800 years before Jesus. And in that time, Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem and the surrounding areas, it's a country known as Judah, they were in serious crisis. The people had indulged in false worship. They mixed traditional Jewish temple practices with idolatry. And the result of that was a whole lot of selfishness and a society that was very unjust. It was made up of the very rich and the very poor and not much in between. It was a total mess. And then the house of cards they had built came crashing down. It came crashing down when the Assyrian Empire, a huge empire to the north of this little tiny nation, Jewish nation, threatened to invade. They started marshaling their troops, they started moving towards Judah, and that intimidating show of military aggression plunged the tiny nation into collective despair. And that's when Isaiah shows up. And he doesn't mince words. He doesn't hesitate to point out where the people failed. But his whole purpose is to give them hope for the future. Look at what he says. He says, "In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established as the highest mountain. It'll be raised above the hills." What does he mean? It's a symbol. He means that no longer would the Jewish people be a disappointment and an embarrassment to God, but they would take their rightful place as God's favored nation. And then Isaiah goes on. He says, "All nations shall stream toward Jerusalem. Many peoples will come and they'll say, 'Come, let us climb the mountain of the Lord. Let's learn about God from the Jewish people. For from Zion," which is another name for Jerusalem, "from Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." What Isaiah is saying is that from this ash heap of religious infidelity, social injustice, political instability, the Jewish people would rise again as a model of wisdom, righteousness, and faithfulness, so much so that all people would come to them to learn about the one true God. And the result, Isaiah says, would be a more peaceful world, where people beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and there won't be war anymore. Isaiah's words create a beautiful vision of a hopeful future, and it was all designed to comfort this worried nation of Judah. But then, at the end of all these hopeful images, did you catch this? Isaiah issues a challenge. He says, "O house of Jacob," it's another word for Israel, "O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord." You see, what he's saying is that the future is up to them. They are in control of their own future. The choices they make in the present will decide whether they will enjoy their destiny or suffer over it. If they walk in the light of the Lord, if they follow his commands, if they remain faithful, Isaiah says God will restore Jerusalem and will give them a second chance to create a great society of justice, truth, and peace. And like the ancient people who were bolstered by that image, that vision of a hopeful future, our worried world, our future, is also up to us. We are in control. The choices we make will create the destiny we all will either enjoy or suffer. We have everything we need to be hopeful. We have the scripture, we have the truth, we have our faith. But the decision to spread that hope is our choice. Hope is up to us. Now, you know, in Noah's time, the ark was the only hope for survival of the human race and really all of creation. And if you think about it, in the same way, we need to build another ark of hope in our worried world today. And we've been doing it for 2,000 years. And that ark is the church. And yes, there have been terrible times in history where the ark has gone off course. We all know those painful points very well. But God always brings that ark back on course. It always is a safe place when God reforms the church. And this ark, everyone is invited aboard it. Together in faith, we can create the future we want to see. And I don't know if you see this, but every day I see this. Every day I see that our church, our little local church right here, is changing lives. I talk to people every day who tell me that. For example, our Sunday masses are attracting people who are finding hope again in their faith. People who haven't been to church in a long time, and they discover us, and they discover the way we do things, the beautiful music, the beautiful lighting, and hopefully good messages. And they're coming back to church. We have small groups that are sustaining people in dark times. We have ministries that give people an opportunity to grow in faith by serving other people. Our young people are meeting Jesus in our children's programs, and they learn to love him. And in January, we're going to launch our brand new Jesus Jam program for kids at the 9 a.m. Mass. It's going to be amazing. Plank by plank, board by board, we are building an ark of hope right here, and you are participating in it. And that's the point. We can't do it alone. We need your help to spread hope in these troubling times. Next weekend is our stewardship weekend. It's the one weekend of the year that we, and the only weekend of the year, I want to point that out, that we ask you to make a financial commitment to this parish. Our world needs us more than ever. And because of that, your local church is the best investment you can make. And I know that many of you participate in ministries, you participate in small groups. We're always talking about those things. But next week, we just want to talk about your financial investment in this parish. So over the next week, I invite you to pray about what God is calling you to give to this parish in the year ahead. We're not asking you to make, you know, bring an extra check, bring a large check. You want to do that? That's fine. That's not the point. The point is to simply have you sit down with your family or with God, if you're without a family, and just pray about what you're going to give this church week by week or month by month next year. And, you know, if you're married, discuss it with your husband and wife. Sometimes couples don't give anything because they can't agree on what to give. If that's you, take some time to talk about it. And as you're thinking about this, we encourage you to consider the four P's of giving. First of all, be intentional in your giving to this parish. Don't just give as an afterthought. Plan it out. Then, second, make giving a priority in your budget. When you're going through your household budget, put giving, your charitable giving as the top line, the top expense. Make it first of all and above all. Third, keep in mind the biblical standard of the tithe, which means 10%. I know in the Bay Area, probably can't do that or can't do that initially, but what you can do is choose a percentage to give back to God. Even if you start with 1% of your income, even if you start with 0.5%, pick a percentage because percentage giving is the game changer when it comes to giving in faith as well as growing in faith. When I was a young priest, I never gave anything to the church. I thought to myself, I gave my whole life. Why should I give my checkbook? And then I started getting smart and learning about stewardship, and now I give. And I started with a very small percentage, and I worked my way up, and I'm going to increase my percentage this year to this parish. And that's the last P. Look to progress in your giving, growing your percentage year after year while budgeting and spending in ways that actually allow you to do that. So after Mass, when you leave, we'll be distributing stewardship cards. I know this may be a little foreign to some of you. Protestants are really familiar with this whole thing, but I just ask you to please keep an open mind. Please take the handout home with you. It's got a financial statement of our parish, so you can take a look at how we've been doing. And pray about it, and then fill out the card, the commitment card. that you believe, with the amount that God is, you think is God is calling you to give in the year ahead, and then bring it back next week. You can also find the card online at sthillary.org for those of you who are watching. For those of you who currently support our parish and contribute financially, thank you. On behalf of all of us, thank you. Your giving makes all of this possible. This only happens because of your giving. For those of you who have been coming for a while in person or watching online and haven't yet joined our team of givers, can I invite you to take the opportunity this Stewardship Sunday to do that? Maybe it's time. And here's the thing, it isn't so much about the money. It's about the heart, your heart. Jesus told us, for where your treasure is, there also your heart will be. Wherever you put your money, absolutely, positively, your heart will follow. It isn't so much about the money, it's about your heart. We want your heart, because your heart is where hope grows. And life may not always be wonderful in every moment, but investing in bringing hope for a worried world, investing in this arc of hope, well, that's just a wonderful way to live and to give.